You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. You're listening to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thank you for subscribing on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on Himalaya. My name is David Ramil. Today's show is brought to you by Built Bar, the best tasting protein bar I've ever had. And we're continuing our series on the greatest what-if scenarios in Miami Heat franchise history. Some of the biggest questions, some of the biggest possibilities that might have taken place over the 30 years of the team's existence. A fascinating trip down memory lane on a lot of instances where I've talked about a number of potential signings that never quite worked out, or what if a player had come here and didn't, and things of that sort. Today's show is along those same lines, continuing to talk about what would have happened if maybe Pat Riley's role in Miami would have been different, or maybe he never even had a role in Miami. I think it's a great conversation. Riley obviously joined the team in 1995, and so he's inextricably linked to so many of the key moments in Heat history, obviously worth talking about. But I also wanted to bring up something from yesterday's podcast. It felt kind of wrong not to bring it up. I mentioned yesterday, or on yesterday's topic anyway, it was about Alonzo Mourning and discussing all the various what-ifs surrounding his career. Obviously, in 1995, shortly after Riley joined the team, he acquired Alonzo Mourning. There was a great deal of discussion on my end from whether or not Zoe could have not joined the team in 95. He could have elected to stay in Charlotte for one more year and then enter unrestricted free agency in 1996 and re-sign with either Charlotte or sign with another team or maybe even sign with Miami again. But even further down the line, as I was talking about Zoe's career, he chose to sign with the New Jersey Nets in 2003, but there were a number of other suitors there, and one of which was the Dallas Mavericks. He was actually very, very close to signing with the Mavericks, but felt that with the depth of the Western Conference, joining the Mavs would have been a more difficult path towards an NBA championship. And that was his ultimate goal at that point in his career, having accomplished already so much on an individual level, but wanting to achieve the greatest level of team success. And so he thought that the trip to New Jersey would result in a championship, knowing that the Nets had been able to make it to the finals the past couple of seasons. They went to two consecutive trips to the NBA finals, and unfortunately it didn't quite work out that way. Zoe never quite regained his form, and for, you know, the Nets, they wound up trading away Jason Kidd, and it changed the roster so dramatically, which is why Alonzo forced his way out of New Jersey. But it could have been a very fascinating what-if scenario if he had joined the Mavs instead, if maybe he had propelled Dallas to a championship over Miami in 2006, if he had won a ring with Dallas instead of having joined Miami in 2005 and helping them gain the championship the following season. So it was a very, very different scenario. Look, I mean, there were so many different possibilities there. Even when he was forced out of Toronto, or when he forced his way out of Toronto, because he did agree to a buyout. So I don't think I discussed that very much. Going back now in my memory, I can't recall whether or not I talked much about that buyout, but the situation in New Jersey obviously became untenable for him. He didn't want to be part of a rebuilding situation in New Jersey, so they traded him. They traded him to Toronto in exchange for Vince Carter. Vince Carter went to the Raptors, and he wound up having a pretty good career there, at least for that stop anyway. Alonzo refused to report to the Raptors. They had a very bad reputation at that point. They were rebuilding as well, especially after losing, McGrady in 2000 to the Orlando Magic and Vince Carter being traded away. They weren't going to be competing for a playoff spot anytime soon. It was obviously, being in Canada, I think a lot of players viewed the Raptors as mostly an expansion franchise. That's the sense that I got at that point in time, was that nobody really saw Toronto as a legitimate NBA stop. It wasn't an established franchise. They didn't have much actual team success at that point in time. So for Zoe, he just didn't want to be a part of that rebuilding process. And so he asked for a buyout. He received it. Apparently, I think the numbers were about $9 million of what was left of his contract at that point in time, and he was bought out of his deal. But he could have signed with anybody. He chose to come back to Miami at that point in time. But he was an unrestricted free agent. He could have joined any team. And there were a number of other suitors. I remember even going back to 2003, there was a graphic on ESPN when they was first discussing the potential options for Alonzo, and they showed Zoe in a Mavs uniform, a Heat uniform, of course, a Celtics uniform, and a Spurs uniform. So that was very interesting to see that there were other teams vying for Zoe's talents, even as far back as 2003. So just something I felt like I should bring up, because I did not go into that kind of detail, which I really wanted to, as far as the potential what-ifs there. If he had joined Dallas and won a championship with Dirk Nowitzki a few seasons later over the team in which he had his best seasons as an NBA player. So moving on, it's time to get into Pat Riley a little bit about his role with the team. And I don't know how to really start the subject here other than at the beginning, because the reality is that anything talking, any kind of item related to or historical context about this team has to begin with Pat Riley. Like, everything that's happened with this team since 1995 has been so completely and totally linked with Riley and his role here that it's just impossible to separate him and everything that he does, or rather what he's done over the course of his, well, now 25 years with the franchise. So cannot overstate how important a move it was, but also it was a fascinating one from an administrative tampering perspective. Like, there were so many small details there. Look, he had enjoyed some success in New York. He was able to make it to the finals the year before. Think about that. He had managed to go to the NBA finals just a couple seasons earlier to face the Houston Rockets. They wound up losing in 1994, but they were the Eastern Conference champs that first year after Michael Jordan retired. So a very impressive run for Riley. Fell short the following season when the Orlando Magic wound up going all the way to the NBA finals against those same Rockets teams. But either way, Riley was in it for the long haul in New York. He was a perfect fit there after establishing the Showtime era, or at least continuing the Showtime era in Los Angeles. He kind of lost touch with that team, with Magic Johnson, and they needed a change there. And so he took some years off to go into broadcasting, and then kind of got that itch to go back into the coaching ranks and took over a Knicks team there and wound up, again, enjoying much success. Gaining a few players out of the CBA, that was the Continental Basketball Association, guys like Anthony Mason and John Starks. He wound up, getting their careers a whole new starting point, because they were guys that wouldn't have fit into the league if not for a guy like Riley. So always already establishing a history of reclamation projects and things of that sort. But he also established the physicality that was necessary to win in the Eastern Conference at that point, continuing what was established by the Detroit Pistons a few years earlier, and continuing what the Knicks would do, what the Indiana Pacers would do. So many teams trying to find an answer to a question, the Michael Jordan question, that never really got answered. So, it was very interesting for him to be able to create a whole new style of play in New York. And I think a lot of people viewed that pairing of Riley and New York is one that would last a while and would eventually lead to a championship. But in 1995, there were some major conflicts between Riley and the rest of the front office. Dave Checketts, the president of basketball operations for the New York Knicks, and Ernie Grunfeld just couldn't see eye to eye regarding Riley's role and his decision-making process. He wanted to add a few players there that they weren't keen on. And so he wanted more control, theoretically, or at least that's been reported. He wanted more control over the roster, and he wasn't going to get it in New York. And so he had to look elsewhere for an opportunity to get that kind of control. And that's when the first contact was made with the Miami Heat. I'll get into that in the next segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. So I've been talking to you about Built Bar over the last few weeks, and I'm going to continue to do so because, honestly, it's such a great opportunity for you to get the best tasting protein bar I've ever had. One of the things that I keep coming back to is how easy it is to just grab a protein bar. I know that's the point of it. You just grab a bar and go. But right now, things are pretty hectic. For me personally, even with the pandemic, you still don't have much time to cook. Sometimes you just don't really feel like cooking. With a one-year-old toddler, believe me, I've got my hands full. I can't always sit down to have a full meal. And that's where Built Bar comes in. So me and my wife can just grab a bar, grab a snack that'll help tide us over for a while. And it feels great, and it tastes great too. There are so many different flavors. 21 options right now for you to choose from banana chocolate cream to mint chocolate to caramel. I mean, you name it. Any kind of flavor you might like, you're going to find it on a Built Bar. And that's why it's such a great opportunity for you to take advantage of right now. They're good for you. They have high protein, low calories, low sugars, low carbs, all the things that you're looking for, the nutrients that you need, and great taste too. So go to BuiltBar.com. That's BuiltBar.com. Use the promo code LOCKEDON and you'll get $10 off your first order. You can get a box of any kind, different assorted items. You can mix and match. It's a great opportunity. Again, go to BuiltBar.com. Use the promo code Locked On for $10 off a great tasting protein bar that's good for you too. June 15th, Pat Riley officially resigned from the New York Knicks, June 15th, 1995. But the problem was that 10 days earlier, on June 5th, a memo received by Mickey Arison, the controlling partner of the Miami Heat at that point in time, who had just taken over the team, had received a very detailed memo, a 14-page memo, detailing all the different things that Riley wanted out of a position with a team, not to mention his role as a head coach and president of basketball operations, but also 20% interest in the team as far as an ownership stake, $300 per diem, living expenses covered by the team. So he was getting an incredible package, or at least that's what he requested and they eventually would get. But sending that memo 10 days before he was officially resigned for the New York Knicks was a problem. And the Knicks were pretty salty about it. As I mentioned in the first segment, that pairing between Riley and the Knicks seems like it was going to go for a long time. And they kind of felt like they had the rug pulled from underneath them and they were not too happy with Riley or the Heat. And so they levied tampering charges against the team. They brought it up to NBA Commissioner David Stern at that point in time. And Stern theoretically had a problem with Riley and the New York Knicks. He felt, a lot of people have theorized that Stern, being from New York, felt betrayed by Riley because he was betraying the hometown team, the New York Knicks that Stern had grown up following. I'm not so sure about that. Maybe there was butting heads. I think mostly is that just Riley and the move to join Miami just felt like they had complete autonomy. Like they could do whatever they wanted to. And I could understand from Stern's perspective why he wanted to slap Riley across the wrist or slap the Heat across the wrist. Because honestly, I mean, that kind of sets a bad precedent. I know tampering happens in the league all the time. You can go back to the 2010 Miami Heat. You can go back to any kind of combination. You can go back to Draymond Green whispering in KD's ear to come to the Golden State Warriors. That's going to be some form of tampering. People are human and makes sense. I understand it completely. But there still seems, even from my perspective, something a little underhanded. And Riley kind of saying, look, this is what I want from Knicks management, and Knicks management kind of entertaining that option and maybe discussing it, trying to figure out how they can make Riley happy. And at that point in time, Riley's already saying, no, fuck this. I'm out of here. I want to go play somewhere else. I'm tired of living in New York. I used to spend my summers out in a beach house in Los Angeles with my wife, Chris, playing volleyball and doing God knows what else during the 70s. I want to get back to that kind of fun loving in the sun. And so maybe Miami just seemed like a much more interesting option. I can totally understand that perspective, but it just seemed a little underhanded, which is why Pat the Rat, that moniker, was established by Knicks fans. He forces his way out of New York. The Heat wind up giving a first-round draft pick as compensation for adding Riley. They also pay Riley a huge amount of money, $3 million a year, basically, over the course of his contract, plus all the other incentives I talked about, 10% ownership in the team, and then an extra 10% over the course of his tenure with Miami. So I imagine at this point in time, if that's played out, I guess I could look it up, but he's probably has a 20% ownership stake in Miami, which is pretty impressive for a head coach or executive. At that point in time, he was just a coach and an executive as well. But now in his front office role, I don't think it's usual for most general managers to have that kind of a stake in a team. But either way, it's an interesting partnership that was established in 1995. But what if things had played out differently? Like, that's the whole point of this discussion here is, you know, what if the tampering charges were too much? What if the Knicks were a little bit more open to relenting and giving Riley what he wanted? And maybe coming to Miami with his family wasn't as much of a draw as we assume it was, and that he could have been bought to stick around in New York for a while. What if he just says, you know what, thank you, Mickey. Sorry for getting you involved in this, but I don't want to give up a first-round pick. I don't want to go through that process. I don't like Miami's currently constructed roster. I mean, we can assume that Riley had, you know, problems with the roster as it was currently comprised in 1995. I mean, he looked at it within a month of his actual hiring date and said, sorry, Glenn Rice, you're out of here. And he acquired Alonzo Mourning shortly thereafter. But I don't know that Alonzo was already a disgruntled Hornets employee when he was officially hired by Miami. So maybe he would have accepted the position even without Alonzo Mourning. I mean, he did accept the position without Alonzo, but maybe he had some inkling that Alonzo could be pried away from Charlotte. But maybe he didn't. Maybe he was going to go ahead and take over a team with Glenn Rice and just use that moving forward. Something I discussed yesterday is, what if Alonzo had just stayed in Charlotte for a year? But what if he just says, you know what, I don't want to be part of that Heat team. I want to stay in New York. I want to stick around. I made a promise to Patrick. I made a promise to John Starks and Anthony Mason. I've got some good coaching options here with Jeff and Stan Van Gundy. There's no need for me to move on any further. I'm happy here. My family's happy here. And I can make sure that I get an opportunity to carry this team to a championship, the championship that I promised this team. It never worked out that way for the Knicks. It never worked out that way, obviously. But it's just an interesting possibility there because with all the drama, and it was a lot of drama. Again, I mean, this is a different era. This is 1995. And still, you can Google search pretty easily what happened there. There was a whole fax resignation from Pat Riley. There were the tampering charges. There was the possibility of him meeting with Mickey Arison days before he resigned. There was so much of that drama, the fact that the league got involved. I was looking at an article right now from the New York Times looking at the tampering charges specifically, and the only time that they had issued any kind of tampering fines before during David Stern's tenure, because again, the understanding is that every team tampers to some degree, was in the 80s when Hakeem Olajuwon was with the University of Houston and the Portland Trailblazers were trying to determine whether or not they could make him their first pick or their second pick in the draft. They wound up taking Sam Bowie, of course, and Michael Jordan famously wound up going third to the Chicago Bulls. But it was interesting that they were already reaching out to Hakeem Olajuwon. That was in the 80s, the early 80s. And since then, Stern had been pretty much out of, you know, he wasn't forced to levy any kind of tampering charges against any other team. This was such a particularly egregious situation that David Stern had to say, God damn it, what are you doing here? You're really putting me on the spot. You've already gone ahead and agreed to join the Heat. You're still a Knicks employee. You can't do that. And so it sets, again, a bad precedent, which is why they wound up charging the Heat a first-round pick, as well as some money, too, if I recall correctly. The Knicks were unconditionally seeking one of Miami's two first-round draft picks in 96 and $3 million. So they got paid because of this whole thing. It was such a fiasco from the league perspective, a blemish that was, you know, a league trying to recover from the loss of Michael Jordan, although obviously he had returned famously in 1995, wound up losing in the playoffs to the Orlando Magic, but Michael was back, and so they were trying to kind of rebuild their image. They were trying to figure out who would carry the league in Michael's absence, and so that's, the Knicks were primed to do that. Riley could just as easily have stayed in 1995 and carry this team there, but I just found that to be such a fascinating situation with Riley and everything else, and it could have worked out very, very differently there. But of course, Riley winds up coming to Miami in 1995. He winds up acquiring Alonzo Mourning, Tim Hardaway, making several roster moves over the next six or seven seasons. They're this close to getting to the championship. Unfortunately, they wound up getting beat by the Knicks in 99 when they were the first seed in the Eastern Conference after Michael Jordan retired yet again. But they lose to Jeff Van Gundy and the Knicks, one of the worst losses in Heat franchise history, I think. And then from that point, Alonzo's kidneys wound up taking the team out of contention. Riley stays on as head coach of the Knicks. I'm sorry, head coach of the Heat for a few more seasons there. They wound up trying to get the most out of Eddie Jones and Brian Grant and Anthony Mason. Sorry, not Anthony Mason. Anthony Mason was only for 1 year. Trying to get the most out of them. They wound up drafting Caron Butler in 2002. They wound up acquiring Lamar Odom as a free agent in 2003. They drafted this young kid out of Marquette University in 2003. But right before the eve of training camp in 2003, Riley makes the most surprising decision, perhaps, in his history with the team, and he announces his resignation. What would have happened if he had just stayed with the team in 2003? That's an interesting question, too, because I feel like Dan Van Gundy wound up doing an incredible job in Miami. I think for a team like Dwayne Wade, Lamar Odom, Caron Butler, those were young players, they needed somebody a little bit different. Riley, it's not that he's necessarily a rough personality. He's a very demanding and exacting one. And I think it would have been too much if Riley had stayed with the team in 2003, and maybe he wouldn't have helped get the most out of Dwayne Wade. Maybe he wouldn't have known what to do with Dwayne. Maybe he wouldn't have given Lamar the same opportunities, or maybe he would have forced more out of guys on that roster, and maybe would have rubbed a lot of those players the wrong way, or maybe they would never have reached their potential. Everything is so tenuous in the NBA, and it's a point that I keep coming back to, but I think it's one that bears repeating because So much of this could have been changed. Now Riley made the decision 100% on his own. He said, you know what? I can't. I don't want to take over this team in 2003. They got some good young players. I'm curious to see about Dwayne's growth and personality and everything else, but I'm just not ready to continue, you know, coaching. I'm ready to step back and give somebody else the opportunity. Stan was in the wings waiting for that opportunity, and he did a fantastic job. And in 03-04, obviously, helped carry the team to the playoffs where Dwayne Wade's star began to be fairly established as one of the youngest, most versatile players in the NBA. But maybe he never gets that opportunity if Riley stays on as coach. More importantly, when Stan Van Gundy officially resigns in 2005, what if that never happens? What if Pat Riley never takes over the team in 2005? Do they wind up winning a championship the following season? I'll talk about it in the next segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Even now in the midst of a pandemic, I got to be honest with you, it's still hard to find the time to sit down and read a book. I just don't have much free time, again, with a toddler, with a family, with work and everything else that's involved in my daily life. Sometimes it's just not easy for me to sit down and read a book, but you still want to gain some of that information. It's key for people to change, to get new information, and that's where one of the best apps that I have is called Blinkist. It's available for us, and it helps me so much. It's an incredible app that solves this problem. I highly recommend it. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser, wherever you want to go on the internet, and it takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them to down just to 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. You've got all sorts of subjects from history to science to relationships. There's just so many different fields that you can get into. All sorts of thousands of nonfiction titles, and you can have them condensed to just 15 minutes. If you're struggling for time, but you want to be able to continue to grow, learn, and change as we all do, then Blinkist is the right app for you. 12 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library, so many different options and titles for you to choose from, and you can absolutely take advantage of this offer right now. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, all for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/NBA and try it free for 7 days. Save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/NBA to start your free 7-day trial. You'll also save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/NBA. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as an Apple Podcast, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're in iTunes, please leave a rating and review, especially if it's a good one. Pat Riley, he's stepped down from the coaching sidelines. He's no longer prowling the sidelines in his Armani suits. And Stan Van Gundy, rumpled, rolled up sleeves, sweating profusely, frustrated at every opportunity, has taken over the team and done, by all accounts, a pretty damn good job. In 2003 and 04, he winds up guiding the team to a 42-40 record. And of course, they wind up making the playoffs in Dwayne Wade's first season as an NBA player. In the second season, his 04-05 season, they obviously acquire Shaquille O'Neal, and Van Gundy does an even better job, guiding the team to a 59-23 record. Eddie Jones, a rising star in Dwayne, and Shaq wind up taking that team to the third highest win percentage total in franchise history. That's a phenomenal mark there, 59-23. Obviously, the 66-16 team during the Big Three era, and then Riley's own 61 win team in 96-97 with the second highest win total in franchise history. But 59-23, Stan Van Gundy did a phenomenal job of getting the most out of Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade. And then something changes after they wind up losing the Eastern Conference Finals to the Detroit Pistons, who wind up losing to the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA Finals. Van Gundy did a really, really good job of coaching that team, of getting them to the Eastern Conference Finals. And we're probably one injury away, or maybe two injuries, both Shaq and Dwayne injured during the playoff series against the Pistons. They could have gone all the way to the NBA Finals, maybe even won a championship. And so it's another big what if there. I can't really predict how that would have played out, because unfortunately it's just a matter of injury there. Maybe if both players are healthy, are they able to advance past Detroit? More than likely. If they're able to beat San Antonio at that point in time, that's another possibility too. I think Tim Duncan, as good as he was, wouldn't have been able to match up with Shaq very well. He clearly hadn't been able to do so when Shaq was with the Lakers, and Shaq was an MVP that season, despite what the award actually going to Steve Nash that year. So an interesting conversation for another time. Who knows? Maybe they could have won a championship in 05, but it didn't quite work out that way. They were this close. But the expectation during the 2005-2006 season was that Miami would again compete for a title. And then that all changed after they started off with a very, very slow start there. They went 11-10 to start the team. Of course, Pat Riley pulling off one of the biggest trades in NBA history, moving a ton of players around, sending Eddie Jones to Memphis, getting Jason Williams in exchange, Antoine Walker, of course, just completely retooling the team around Shaq and Dwayne. So you have to wonder, you know, when he makes a move like that, that it's going to present a huge challenge for Stan, and wonder whether or not Stan wound up having any kind of input regarding that decision-making process, because it's already going to be difficult to coach a personality, an outsized personality like Shaquille O'Neal, and then having to get even new players, a guy like, you know, Jason Williams and Antoine Walker, and signing Gary Payton, a very, very outspoken player. All these different factors there. It was a particularly challenging one for Stan Van Gundy. And then December 12th of 2005, Stan unexpectedly resigns, and Pat Riley takes over the team. Now, I can totally understand why Stan did it, as I just laid out. There were so many different personalities there, and that's probably the most difficult aspect of any coaching. It's not just the X's and O's that you have to worry about. I think most coaches are qualified for that, but the personality management of getting the most out of every player, getting them all on the same page, getting them to understand their role is incredibly taxing. And you see it all the time with coaches that just fall short, even though there are talents and players on their roster that just can't seem to get them to connect. And for Stan, it wound up becoming too much for him, and so he resigned. Now, there's plenty of drama into that resignation. Both Stan and Pat Riley have squashed that rumor completely. And a lot of people tend to assume that with Riley's cutthroat approach to, well, life in general, that he probably undercut Stan and wound up forcing Stan out, forcing him to resign so he could take over as coach. I don't buy it. I think both men have said enough times that there was no undercutting taking place there. Now, that's not to say Riley didn't make a difficult situation even more difficult by pulling off this huge offseason trade to acquire Williams and Walker, etc. That was a lot of personality to deal with on one roster, and it might have been too much for a guy who was in just his third season as a head coach. I mean, he had taken over a very young team in 03-04 with Dwayne and Lamar and Caron, and then he wound up taking this huge star-studded team with Shaquille O'Neal, and then that changed even more. And so, you know, it's incredibly challenging to have to deal with a new retooled roster every time, and for Stan, that might have just been too much for him to handle. Maybe Riley did want to take over that kind of personality. Maybe he was willing to take over that. And either way, he did step in right away and, of course, wound up taking over the team and guiding them to a championship in 2006. But a lot of that had to do with Dwayne Wade's incredible individual performances. Of course, Alonzo Mourning playing huge and during the playoffs and in the NBA Finals. Gary Payton having key moments there. Shaquille O'Neal. Everybody stepped up to some degree. There was a lot of different talented players on that roster, and Riley was at least able to get them to play at the same level there. So I don't think Stan resigns that anybody else would have taken over. I don't think there would have been a coaching change midseason or anything like that. And I think the discussion from Stan and Pat Riley was just, you know, look, I can't take this. You know, Shaq's a jerk. There are just too many jerks on this team. I can't handle this. And Pat's probably like, well, what's going on? What do you mean there are too many? You have to handle this. You have to find a way to get to them. It's like, no, Pat, I can't do it. I want to spend time with my family. I just don't want to deal with this. This is not what I signed up for when I took over as coach in 2003. All right. So he steps down. Pat doesn't see any other option. He says, all right, I guess I got to do it. We all know that Pat Riley is very hands-on, even as a front office executive, and so he just slides right in there, and again, he's able to get the most of that team and winds up leading them to a championship. So I don't know that there's a necessary what-if to that scenario. I just find it interesting that there was this possibility that Stan could have just kept it going. Would he have enjoyed the same kind of success? Probably not. If he's already feeling that kind of pressure, it might have been just too much for him to deal with. Although he wound up having an incredibly successful season just the year before. And so that was with a different, less talented roster, less experienced roster anyway, in 04-05. And he wound up having 59 wins. And so he was certainly qualified, and he had some great success when he joined the Orlando Magic later on. He didn't really have too much winning success in Detroit as when he took over as a team, but that was mostly because he was handling both the general manager role and the coaching role. Never quite worked out very well around the league. I think Pat Riley might be the exception to that rule, but either way, Riley steps in, guides the team to a championship, and then something similar happens in 2010 when the Big Three joins in. And what happens when Eric Spoelstra gets bumped by LeBron and so many people are calling for Spoelstra's ouster? I don't know if I was one of them, to be honest with you. I was convinced that Spo was going to be a pretty good coach. I don't know that I was a huge fan of his necessarily, and it's tough to not want Pat Riley kind of step in there. So that's another huge question, and I think one that a lot of people have asked to death here, is what would have happened if Riley had stepped over in 2010? And the reality is he probably would have gotten the team to be a very successful one. I don't know that he necessarily would have gotten them to a championship. I think that's a legitimate question. I think Riley was a little too set in his ways, a guy who was a little bit too dependent or familiar or comfortable with a center to dominate the team. That just wasn't who the Miami Heat were during the Big Three era. You're not going to get a lot of success with Joel Anthony or Eric Dampier or Zydrunas Ilgauskas taking over your center spot there. We all know famously that Riley was very opposed to Chris Bosh taking over the center spot, that he just didn't like the concept of small ball, that for him it's about dragging out the game, getting in there, pounding the ball into the low post, all the things that we kind of shied away from since then. And I think Spoelstra was at least flexible enough, being a young person, a young coach, and recognizing that there was this great talent in Chris Bosh, who had this incredible versatility and this willingness to evolve and grow. I don't know that Riley would have made that same recognition. I honestly think that maybe if Riley had taken over as coach in 2010 and fired Spoelstra inexplicably, maybe he would have found a way to trade Chris Bosh for, say, Dwight Howard, another similar type center, a guy who might have been able to guide the team to a championship, at least in Riley's vision of what a championship team looks like or a championship roster looks like. Probably one of the more interesting questions there for Riley is, I don't think he's ever asked her that, been asked or answered this, but would he have wanted to take over the team and would he have made changes and try to, move Chris around for a more established, typical or legitimate center, It's very fascinating to know that he had that, that was an option. We've all heard the story that LeBron has kind of picked Riley's brain a little bit and tried to see, gauge his interest to see whether or not he might be willing to step down as the executive and kind of slide back into the head coaching job. And Riley famously turned that notion down and decided to give Spoelstra a chance. Obviously paid off with 4 straight trips to the finals and 2 straight championships. But when you're looking at all this and there's so many other what-ifs involved with Riley, what if he had signed such and such player? What if he, doesn't push Dwayne out the door? What if he doesn't, put LeBron on the spot in 2014? What if he makes a different change to the roster, et cetera? And something that happened actually this past weekend, and I think it bears pointing out, there was an Inside Stuff Zoom conference call with some of the greatest players of the 90s, guys for like Dominique Wilkins, Tim Hardaway, Glenn Rice, Shaquille O'Neal, Gary Payton, et cetera, et cetera. And Shaq and GP, I think, are the two players that I want to talk about mostly because they brought up a story when Shaq was at a point of where he wanted to choke Pat Riley, and Gary Payton, kind of egging him on during the conference call, said, I'm glad I stopped you because I was going to choke him next. And what stood out to me that is, one, they're kind of oversharing a little bit too much now. They're retired. It's a little bit different. You don't have to play the game necessarily. You don't have to play the politics. But one of the things that I find really interesting is how much we kind of overvalue coaches. We see like these larger than life mythic presences in a Phil Jackson or a Riley or somebody along those lines. And a lot of that it doesn't really matter. The players have full dominion over the control of the team. The coaches just kind of have to be managers more than anything. They are very much game managers in the sense that they are managing personalities, kind of doling out minutes, trying to figure out things. They're balancing things more than anything else. They don't control anything. The players control everything. And so it just, as much as we give credit to Pat Riley, he probably doesn't deserve as much credit. He deserves a lot of credit. He's kept the team together. He's built teams up and down several times over the course of his tenure. He did some fantastic job coaching teams, various different kinds of iterations of the team. But the reality is that any kind of championship success here, and even if you look at the building of the Big Three, probably most of that has to do with Dwayne more than Pat Riley. And maybe some part of that credit should go to Andy Ellisberg and the team there, who was able to massage the salary cap in just such a way to build that kind of roster. But the reality is that Riley's importance is both overestimated and underestimated. Like, he's done a phenomenal job in terms of his ability to maintain this team, to be part of this group for 25 years. Like, that's something that you don't really see much more anymore. I think you'll never see an executive stay with a team for so long and enjoy that kind of success from the 90s, the aughts, and now the 2010s, to build legitimate contenders so regularly, to keep a team winning so frequently. That kind of credit absolutely goes to him. Now, was he the only person responsible for that? No, he was not. And so it just, there were so many different things that Riley could have done different, that he probably could have done better. When you're looking at the what if scenarios there, maybe a lot of them work out pretty badly if Riley does things a little bit differently. You know, if he had stepped in a little bit sooner or stepped in for Spoelstra, they might not win a championship there. Maybe they change the roster completely, you know. And again, LeBron would have been the guy to carry the team, but maybe he would have felt comfortable working alongside Riley. Maybe he wouldn't have. Maybe Riley would have pushed him the same way he pushed him in 2014. Would Dwayne Wade have yelled on the sidelines in 2012 at Pat Riley the same way he did at Eric Spoelstra? Probably not. But at the same time, maybe Spoelstra, you know, knew how to get the most out of Dwayne, maybe knew how to force him into having a good game. And maybe Riley would have pushed him through some longer practices that might have wound up, well, taking more out of his legs and costing him a couple years off his career. It's hard to see this in retrospect and in hindsight, because there's just no way of knowing how it would have turned out. But what if Riley takes over the team in 2010, trades Chris Bosh away, and then winds up relying on Dwayne Moore, but also having him go through 2.5-3 hour type practices where they wind up, you know, costing him his knees and his health, and even further, you know, deteriorates his health to a point where he's no longer a factor. Maybe he forces LeBron's hand even sooner, and LeBron leaves in 2014, and you know, maybe he demands a trade in 2013. They don't win a championship there because that combination of LeBron, Dwayne, an older Dwayne, or a worn down Dwayne and Dwight Howard aren't necessarily going to win a title. So it's just a very, very interesting concept there. So many different questions. Look, it's hard, again, to separate Riley from the Heat. And I think that's the biggest thing here, is that he hasn't been perfect. He's been far from it. And his role as a coach has probably been over-exaggerated more than anything else. But the reality is that he is the most defining figure in Heat franchise history. And so he is as unique an executive as any that this league has ever seen. And he deserves a lot of recognition for that. If not credit necessarily, at the very least, recognition for his incredible role as you know, helping reshape and rebuild this team over and over again, and getting them to become a championship contending team for so many years. Special thanks go out to Built Bar for sponsoring today's show. Make sure to check out Rejecting the Screen with Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko, as well as Chad Ford's Big Draft Board, now both in the Locked On Podcast Network. That's it for today. You can connect with me on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat or email me at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. I'm David Ramil signing off and thanking you as always for your support. Yeah! Wrap it up, Dean.